Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 20th of September 2016, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And we will be joined by live video Skype link by David Ellis from Strategic Defence Initiatives. We're going to be having a little bit of an in-depth look at what's been happening in and around Britain's military. Brief comment on the weather. It was nice and sunny with lots of blue sky here in Plymouth. It's now overcast. Reports across the country vary, but quite a few places still sunny. So lucky you, I think, is the right comment for that. So Syria, Mike.
Yes, we'll get straight in with Syria here. Here's The Guardian. The US blames Russia after the UN aid convoy in Syria is targeted by air attack. And what seems to have happened is that a Syrian Red Crescent aid convoy was attacked while they were at a warehouse west of Aleppo at around 7:30 last night, local time. And that was half an hour, apparently, after the ceasefire ended. The so-called activists on the ground say that that was the Syrian and Russian air forces that had restarted attacks, airstrikes. So, of course, it was the Russians and the Syrians that did it. They are saying that regime helicopters targeted a Syrian Red Crescent warehouse and dropped barrel bombs, 8 barrel bombs, 25 vehicles were burnt out, the fire still burning, and so on. But look at who it was. Sorry, just put that back up again, Theo. Look at who it was that that was being rolled out to talk about this and declare that it was the Syrian government and the Russians that were doing the bombing. None other than the White Helmets. The White Helmets on the BBC this morning on the Today programme, direct from Syria, a White Helmet. I think we've said enough and provided enough evidence about the White Helmets over the last number of weeks and months to make it clear what that represents. So the question is, who was actually responsible for this? Well, of course, most of the information coming from the Aleppo Media Centre, which, as we covered with Vanessa on Monday, of course, is funded by the French Foreign Office. The question is, who benefits from this? In fact, this aid convoy was going to provide aid to Syrian Christians. It could equally have been that it was not regime bombing that did this, that it was a hell cannon fired by ISIS or by al-Nusra Front that hit this aid convoy. There's no evidence either way other than so-called witness testimony from the White Helmets.
Yeah. Well, what I find remarkable is if it's a government helicopter, Mike, you've got fuel, you've got the wherewithal to get that helicopter in the air. We've got massive support now from the Russians. Are we really saying that the Syrian government forces have to resort to using barrel bombs, or have I got that the wrong way around?
Well, this is the claim. I don't know.
The thing just doesn't make sense. But interesting to see a lot of comment in the press, in the media, where questions are being asked about the original air attack that Vanessa Bealey took us through, and Paul Craig Roberts, for instance, is simply saying this is totally the fault of the American government. So very, very hard comments. David, can we invite you in at this stage? What's your thoughts on the attack on the Syrian government forces by the US? We now understand Britain was involved, and the Danish.
Well, it's very clear they don't want a ceasefire or a stabilisation to take effect or take place. So they clearly want the other thing. They want more instability. And I think this very clearly goes back to, warnings that we were sending out 2-3 years ago, saying that the danger here would be causing all this trouble, being involved in all this trouble, expediting all this trouble out in the Near East in order to have the argument and the leverage to give birth to the EU military union, aka EU army, but it's far deeper than that, in order to get the currency stability for the euro. So it's a huge game, and clear. I'm with Vanessa on this. Her take is, and her analysis and research is absolutely first rate. And I've got to reference that back to two comments from senior staff, from an admiral, is that nothing flies out there without the US and Britain knowing about it. And, you know, and who does this service? What's the sort of agenda? So it's pretty apparent. But, and the analogy for, not wanting to patronize anyone, but the analogy here really for everyone, is to think of two props in a scrum. All of a sudden, one prop pops out of the scrum and smacks the other one clean in the eye, you know, and the referee sends the bloke off that's just done the punch, you know. But what the referee hasn't seen, that he's had his finger in his eye for the last 2 minutes in the scrum. So, you know, this is the problem, is that we're not seeing the grassroots, because the mass media doesn't clearly, is hand in glove with the governments on this and doesn't want to articulate. So thanks to like a Paul Craig Roberts, UKC and Vanessa, you know, this message is getting out there.
Yeah. Thank you for that, David. Well, let's have a look at what Theresa May's been trying to say. This is from Press TV, but very clear quote. She says, "We're not in Syria to hit government forces. Britain would fully contribute to investigations about a series of airstrikes by the Western coalition that killed over 60 Syrian government forces in the Syrian city of Dar al-Zawar on Saturday." This is not about killing people, really. We hit government forces. That was a bit of a mistake, Mike, because presumably we didn't know what the target was. Bit of a mistake, little bit of confusion. A few people died. That's not a problem because they were Syrian government forces. And presumably Theresa will call in a sort of Chilcot inquiry, which is capable of sweeping everything under the carpet.
Right, but the main point here is that to try and sort of defuse the angst over what they did on Monday, they are marketing the attack on the bombing of the Red Crescent aid convoy. They're marketing that as being some kind of tit for tat deliberate targeting by the Russians, and there's no evidence for that whatsoever. And it seems like a pretty pathetic attempt to try to take the heat off themselves.
Yeah. And of course, attacks on Putin are going on in other directions.
Well, absolutely, because of course, Putin here has won. This is yesterday's news, really, but we were covering Syria mainly. He won hugely in Russia. So his United Russia Party, I believe, is going to end up with about 70% of the seats in the Duma. The opposition parties were really moaning and whinging about the low turnout because they were saying only 35% of people voted in this. They were complaining that people are disenfranchised in Russia because they see that nothing ever changes and so on. But on the other hand, they didn't give a compelling enough alternative for people to come out and vote for them either. Putin has had a landslide victory. Well, let's have a look at what the Foreign Office had to say about this. They said that state elections, the Duma elections, were held on the 18th of September. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe International Election Observation Mission suggests significant challenges to democracy and individual freedoms, apparently, in Russia. A Foreign Office spokesperson said, "We welcome the OSCE report on the conduct of the Russian Duma elections. The report concludes that although the elections were, quote, transparently administered by the Central Election Commission, democratic commitments continue to be challenged and there are numerous procedural irregularities." The hypocrisy here is unbelievable. The OSCE reports that, quote, "the electoral environment was negatively affected by restrictions to fundamental freedoms and political rights, firmly controlled media, and a tightening grip on civil society. We share these concerns about human rights in Russia. A free and vibrant civil society is crucial for democracy." And for me, that is the key phrase there. A free and vibrant civil society is crucial for democracy. Now, it's not crucial for Russian democracy. It's crucial for the Foreign Office's idea of democracy, the type of democracy that the Foreign Office is trying to export to other parts of the world, and they need a free and vibrant civil society, because civil society, of course, is the NGO and CSO complex which they are absolutely dying to get into Russia, to be effective in Russia, to undermine Putin and destroy what Putin is trying to build there. So the message absolutely clear from the Foreign Office about how hacked off they are with the result.
Free and vibrant sounds a bit George Soros-ish in open society networks, Mike,
indeed.
In that sort of language.
Indeed. Here in the EU, we're getting hints that the Bratislava conference didn't quite go so well. I think they had some nice lunch. According to the Italian prime minister, they had a nice trip up the Danube. He was quite pleased with that, but he wasn't so pleased with the outcome of the event itself. So he said it was a nice cruise on the Danube, but he said if we want to pass the afternoon writing documents without any soul or any horizon, they can do it on their own. And this is Marco Renzi. I do not know what Merkel is referring to when she talks about the spirit of Bratislava. If things go on like this, instead of the spirit of Bratislava, we'll be talking about the ghost of Europe. Well, perhaps that's not such a bad thing. But we do get a hint of the absolute desperation in European circles at the moment, because this is Norbert Röttgen. He's saying that the only alternative, if Britain wants to remain in the single market, is for Britain to continue to pay its dues to the European Union. And he's saying that neither the EU and the UK have an interest in a divorce. After Brexit, the relationship needs to remain as close as possible. The world is more unstable, crazy, and multipolar. Our values of freedom and democracy are under threat. That's not our values, Brian. That's his values. Yeah. So we have to stay closer together. And the way to stay closer together, he says, is for Britain to keep paying our dues to the EU, whether we're in or out. Really, again, this is another example of what seems to be the sheer desperation creeping into the minds of the leadership of the European Union. Where is it going to end?
Well, it seems to be a hint of blackmail there coming through. If you don't do as we, what comes next? Is it the might of the German army? This is going to be a problem because, as we're going to discuss shortly, Britain is not in a position to defend itself. But very threatening, aggressive language from a democracy, we're led to believe.
Yes.
Well, bring in Theresa May. Look away if you're of a weak disposition, because she's been telling world leaders, that famous phrase, world leaders, that Britain has a right to protect its borders. So exactly what has not been happening over many years, she's claiming, well, we have a right to do it. That doesn't mean we're going to do it. And I've put the label as Jezebel on this lady. I think it's pretty appropriate because she's got all the attributes. She's lying to the nation. She likes the makeup and the fancy clothes. And she's clearly not peddling any form of democracy we recognise. So can we trust her? I don't know. You might like to have a look at this photograph of her in the Times, because it's extraordinary. She's got a very heavyweight chain around her neck. Now, I don't know whether she's been into some rather interesting personal sports, possibly, or this is part of her latest wardrobe, or is she actually being controlled by somebody holding the end of that chain?
I don't know. It's quite possible. Here she is again, and I'm sorry to have her moving because that's even more offensive, perhaps. But we're getting more clues as to what, first of all, before we move on to migration, she's talking about modern slavery. And she's saying that she needs to galvanize international actions. This is more globalization, the use of people's suffering to globalize policy. So she's talking about strong law enforcement action, a legislative framework. Effective international cooperation is what she's talking about. So she said the UK is leading the world with our efforts to stamp out modern slavery. I'm determined to drive forward international action to eradicate modern slavery. We've got to keep treating the symptoms and not treat the disease, because, of course, the disease at the end of the day is a lack of economic development. And if there was proper economic development, we wouldn't have any need or market for slavery around the world. Migration, of course, is part of this, because any modern slavery hides under the auspices of migration. This, as we mentioned yesterday, has been part and parcel of the UN meetings that are going on at the moment. And we're getting more clues about the bold plan, as they describe it, to enhance protections of refugees and migrants. And they're saying that they are going to protect the human rights of all refugees and migrants, regardless of status. This includes the rights of women and girls, and promoting their full, equal and meaningful participation in finding solutions. Ensure that all refugees and migrant children are receiving education within a few months of arrival. Prevent and respond to sexual and gender-based violence. Support those countries rescuing, receiving and hosting large numbers of refugees and migrants. And work towards ending the practice of detaining children for the purposes of determining their migration status, and so on. But the key point again here, strengthen the global governance of migration by bringing the International Organization for Migration into the UN system. So this is it, the International Organization of Migration, established in 1951. They say that they are the leading intergovernmental organization on the field of migration. And they work closely with governmental, intergovernmental and non-governmental partners, 165 member states, 8 states holding observer status, offices in 100 countries, and they're dedicated to promoting humane and orderly migration for the benefits of all. So they're promoting humane and orderly migration. They're not doing anything to prevent migration. They're making sure that the migration which is happening, the migration which is being driven, is orderly and humane.
It's like taking cattle to market across the prairies, isn't it, Mike, that the cattle had to be looked after in their journey across the prairies in order to keep the weight on them, in order to keep the value of those animals. But at the other end, they were going to go to market anyway.
Absolutely.
So the migration of people is the same.
Absolutely. And so I'm just going to make one slight comment about this, because UNICEF was tweeting this out today. They're saying that they are putting great pressure on the UN General Assembly with their migration discussions, that these are not refugee children, they're not migrant children, and that the hashtag should be children first. And all I would say to UNICEF is, what are you doing to protect Rolly Post, who is absolutely still being targeted by the United Nations for her allegations regarding child trafficking, child slavery, child sexual abuse, and Rolly Post still under the utmost pressure from the United Nations and the European Union over her allegations and their unwillingness to investigate what she's been saying.
Yeah, and of course, her work started in Romania amongst the orphanages at a time when the Western countries, Britain in particular, the public was being told that everything to do with those orphanages was disastrous, cruel people looking after the children, whereas the reality that Rolly Post discovered is that although many of them were desperately short of money, which meant they simply could not do the right thing in many cases, the people were trying very hard to protect those children. But other influences were coming in to take children, traffic them. And she even discovered that the pharmaceutical industry was using some of the children in orphanages for drug testing, exactly the same sort of thing that we've seen in children's homes in the UK. Mm. So a very brave lady. David, we've covered a bit of ground there on matters global migration and the UN. What is your take on this area at the moment?
Well, I think going back to the comments there from the FCO about what's going on in Russia, I know we're slightly back a bit, but, you know, let them without sin start casting stones. That's the first thing. Secondly, Mrs. May is obviously articulating very much globalist language there and globalist agenda, globalist clearly policy. So this comes back to the cardinal values, doesn't it? What is happening to the MPs who are finding themselves completely moribunded in their own parliament? You know, as John Redwood has said some time ago, this paper puppet parliament. How do they feel realizing that they are completely locked out of their own party and their own parliament by not contributing to representation of the people and policy for the people? The policy here isn't for the people of the UK, because Mrs. May's talking about border control. Okay, then fine, let's see that then. You know, because we've had a lot of that over the recent decades, haven't we? You know, we haven't. You know, so all this is inverted language. It's reversing. And reversing actually what's going on. So I think, you know, what people probably need to do here on with these characters is just take what they're saying, turn it upside down, and then it'll make sense. Mm.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Well, let's, on the subject of things being upside down, let's go back to what's happening with Britain and communist China. So we showed this a few days ago, but it's very relevant. So former Prime Minister David Cameron, glad-handing. And what was this about? Well, the article was about the China National Offshore Oil Corporation basically operating 10% of North Sea oil, which meant, as the Mail correctly said, the Communist Party in Beijing had become the largest crude oil operator in the North Sea. So we put a little header on that saying, relax, EastEnders is really our parliament. Communism is good. But this is exactly what you're talking about, David. We've got common sense logic on its head. And here we've got Cameron shaking the hand of a communist as that man extracts oil from British reserves. Well, we've got another thing coming up here, and The Guardian is pointing out that the UK water regulator is backing plans to open up our water market. And this becomes particularly interesting if we have a look at what's going on in relation to events around communist China. And I'm going to keep using the word communist because this is what we're dealing with. We're not dealing with a Chinese democracy. We're dealing with a corporatist, communist system of government with appalling human rights. So let's bring in the nuclear power generation, which is being offered to China General Nuclear. And that, of course, is for the Hinkley Point power plant. But what many people have missed, it has been reported in print, but generally in small paragraphs, is they're already eyeing up another plant, Bradwell Power Plant in Essex. So here are the Chinese moving deep into British nuclear strategic infrastructure. Oil production we've just mentioned. So there's the offshore oil corporation and Beijing controlling British oil. This one is the national grid. 11 billion market is going to be opened up. That's gas distribution. And already Chinese companies are lining up. China Gas and Fosun, which is apparently based in Shanghai. But of course, these are Chinese government-backed companies. They're nothing to do with genuine free trade. Interestingly enough, the bankers Goldman Sachs were named at the back of this deal. But on it goes. So let's bring in the water, Thames Water. Where already we've got China Investment Corporation with a percentage of that operation. So we're saying it's treason because basically our strategic infrastructure is being given to a hostile power. David, I've got more to come on this, but just to say to you, I didn't know what other word to use, but if you are giving away some of the most important critical infrastructure in your country to a hostile power, and I'll demonstrate how we know China's hostile in a minute, this is treason, is it not?
You could argue that. I mean, one man's business deal and one man's treaty are another man's treason, clearly, you know, and it's just up for, you know, whichever is the major majority there to press it either way. And we can see where we're going at the moment. But this is total nonsense. I mean, you've got to come back to Harold Macmillan when they started to sell off the national assets and national infrastructure. That what we've got here is the beginning of the end of this nation. This is the fundamental demise of the country known as England or Wales or Scotland or Ireland. This is the beginnings of the end of our nation, because there will be nothing if this policy continues. There will be nothing to hang on to. So, you know, dear old Harold Macmillan saying it's like selling off the family silver. Well, that is exactly what they're doing here. And how on earth Parliament hasn't rose up and stopped this, it just beggars belief that you're going to have a foreign power be responsible for nuclear piles, fissile material and critical infrastructure. It just beggars belief. This is beyond insanity. This isn't insanity. This is absolute cold, calm, calculated, hostile takeover. And anybody, any diplomat, for as long as I've known, will tell you one thing where the Chinese are concerned. You either row, row, and they'll do that for quite a while, or you kowtow, and that's what's happened here, clearly.
Right, well, let's have a look at some of the comment that's been bandied around right next to Theresa May, because this is a gentleman, Nick Timothy. He was formerly Joint Chief of Staff. That was up until 2015. And he pointed out in an article for Conservative Home last year that the Chinese state-backed energy company CNNC stated on its website that it was responsible not just for increasing the value of state assets, Chinese state assets, and developing the society, but the building of national defence. So here was a man, quite rightly, telling Theresa May directly that that deals were being put together with very dangerous entities in China. And he also claimed that security experts were worried that the Chinese could build weaknesses into computer systems that would allow them to shut down Britain's energy production at will. And he argued against giving a hostile state, there's the word, a hostile state, access to UK's critical infrastructure. So what happened to this gentleman? He seemed to be on the ball. Well, he got shifted across and he's now director of the New Schools Network. So obviously he was a little bit too on the money with regard to dangers from China. So he's been moved across to the new assault on schools and grammar schools. Couldn't be clearer from this gentleman, David, that he saw what was happening. He saw that a hostile country, communist China, was being given opportunities in this country that were dangerous. Nothing happens.
I couldn't agree more. His analysis is absolutely correct. You know, all credit to the guy. And look where it got him. He's been pushed off into some other lesser arena. You know, he hasn't been promoted to be head of Number 10 policy unit or carried on in Number 10 with Theresa May. He's been closed out. So, you know, who are these people representing? Who are they representing? Who are they trying to fool? Well, they're trying to fool the British public. It's as simple as that. You know, this what Theresa May is doing here with her government is wrong, grossly wrong.
Grossly wrong. So let's follow through on Theresa May, because these are some astonishing comments that have come out of the woman. Here she is. And what does she have to say about the whole business of China? We have a robust regulatory system in place and any inward investment must meet the relevant legal and regulatory standards and requirements. Okay. Well, then it gets better because we've got this. The additional safeguards proposed last week mean that in future there will be a formal gateway through which investments in critical infrastructure are interrogated for their implications for national security. So according to Theresa May, for the last 50, 100 years, 60 years, whatever you want to take, we haven't had any means of screening out dangerous business deals by hostile states. Don't worry, though. That's going to be put in place now as a gateway. So I thought we'd just bring up on screen this little image, which, of course, is straight from MI5. And there we have it, keeping our country safe. Nice little video they have running, showing how busy they are watching everything that's happening in the country. But according to Theresa May, this organisation doesn't exist and she's got to set up a gateway.
Oh, is it not the other... Is it not the other way around? In fact, what she's doing is undermining any work that MI5, MI6 and GCHQ may be doing in this area by creating a new framework which is bound by terms of reference that she designs, whereas she didn't design the terms of reference that the security services operate under.
David, you started to speak.
It's beggar's belief that whatever... Mrs. May and her current interface, you know, think or want to pump out their mantra on this, whatever they think or say and whatever is put in place won't be good enough. And I doubt whether it'll work.
Yeah.
But it's intended not to work.
Exactly.
Intended not to work. So let's bring in this man, former Admiral Boyce, Royal Navy. I have to say I served with this gentleman at one point, and he asked a question where he said that basically the Americans are asserting their right to freedom of navigation in the areas under dispute. This is the China Sea. Will the Royal Navy be supporting our allies in that endeavor? Excuse me, I'm losing my voice a little bit. So we asked in a tweet, we got the Chinese invited to rebuild our nuclear infrastructure. They've got to be friends, but apparently the admirals thinks they're enemies. So there's a little bit of confusion here. And I don't know what this is. Is this ignorance from a very senior former officer? Is it muddle? Is it a few too many gin and tonics in one of the London clubs? Or are we seeing treason? But if we're saying that our senior military people don't understand anymore who's an enemy and who's a friend, then we're getting in particularly interesting times. And at this point, we'll introduce John Redwood. I know you're keen to say a few words on this gentleman. I'll just bring in these two topics, David, and then we'll hand back to you. So here's John Redwood in his diary. I found Sir Michael's statement that he will continue to veto a European army all the time the UK remains in the EU perplexing. Now we are leaving, I do not see it's any business of ours to veto what they're going to do when we leave. It just annoys the very countries we wish to be friends with as we depart. And he went on, he said, nor do I understand how Sir Michael can veto something that already exists and the UK has accepted. The EU has established 18 battle groups, each of battalion strength with a rota so that any two of them can be deployed at any time by the European Council. As the EU's own website sets out, the battle group concept provides the EU with a specific tool in the range of rapid response capabilities. Is this man saying that we think we're out, but we're still in a military sense, David?
Yes. I mean, he's politically articulating, you know, beautifully there, because, you know, we all know now that this is of vital importance to this thing called the European Union. And it requires military union to get control of the budget and the money and the currency and so forth. It's a vital thing. It's the key thing. So thanks, John, for coming, you know, for coming in on this. It would have been lovely if he'd have come in a lot earlier. However, you know, timing being everything in politics, given. But, you know, he's actually just said there exactly sort of what the score is. But, you know, my fear with this is that a lot of this can be very self-fulfilling. And I've been told this by, you know, one particular admiral who run the majority of the budget and the treasury interface, you know, a lot of these things can all of a sudden become self-fulfilling. So my worry here is just how productive John is going to be with pursuing some sort of sensible resolution on this and getting control of policy and implementing sensible policy, because he's just articulated there exactly what the score is. You know, the horse has already been shod. The horse has already been mounted. It's well and truly out of the stable. You know, where are the rest of the MPs coming in on this to say, you know, actually what's going to be the impact for, you know, the United Kingdom and what it's going to mean for everyone? You know, more please, you know.
I'll just read a bit more of his statement, which I've got in front of me. It says, in the the UK has played its part on the multinational rota to provide forces. None are currently deployed, but they could be. There's already a Euro Corps, mainly French and German, stationed in Strasbourg. In parallel, the EU does have naval forces in theatre, and UK is signed up to this. Two of the seven ships on Operation Sophia in the Mediterranean, UK. There is a European military capability and they do wish to grow a bigger and more active army. The conversation of Bratislava reminds us that there are already EU forces and they do wish to strengthen them and make them more active. The UK should leave well alone and ask itself whether it wishes to carry on contributing military forces, as it were, after it's left. So we don't know what the truth is, do we? We don't know whether we've pulled away or are thinking about pulling away from the EU, and that's also going to be a break with military integration, or something a lot more devious is going on in the background, that we're talking about leaving, but that military integration is already totally locked together.
Yeah, I mean, if we're going to be a sovereign country, we've got to have control of our own armed services and the industry that feeds them. So, John, we need clear statements here from him. you know, if we're going to be Brexiting, that means we withdraw from contributing into the EU military structure and that then financial money flow and industrial strain. It's as simple as that. You know, we can't have a we can't sort of say we're Brexiting, but yet then that the EU military is a great idea and we should still carry on being part of it and support it. You know, I'm sorry, that just doesn't stack.
Yeah. Now, let's have a look at this, because, of course, May's name is behind the fact that we've now got 4,000 strong. Oh, it's NATO now. Don't worry, this is not EU, this is NATO, although the NATO contribution is, the NATO forces have got an EU contribution. Is that how it works? But here we are, more forces effectively being put out to taunt Russia, because 4,000 strong force is not a deterrent in any way. What this is doing is making an aggressive statement.
So this is Latvia?
This is Latvia, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, and but then the British, of course, likes to go and train people, because training people is how they play their gangs and counter-gangs game. Well, we're heading off to Egypt to help train the Egyptians. So they've trained 80 EAF forces personnel across 2015-2016. Encounter improvised explosive device, that's CIED, and close protection. And they're sending troops across to do more of this. Fallon said our vital training has helped Egyptian armed forces to defuse dangerous devices as they tackle the threat from our common enemy, terrorism. We are now going to step up that cooperation with our Egyptian allies to help them increase training capacity in their armed forces during, and then it goes on to say that during his visit to Egypt, Fallon had met his the Egyptian defense minister and the chief of staff, and that the discussions included UK defense relationship with Egypt, shared threats, mutual interests, as well as continued work in counterterrorism. I'm sure it involved selling weapons as well.
Well, always a good thing to do on the science, isn't it? Well, on the sale of weapons, it doesn't appear that we are doing so well over F-35s. Russia Today here reporting that the US Air Force is to ground a dozen F-35s, citing poor manufacturing and crumbling material. I take crumbling material to be corrosion problems, which seems pretty remarkable in what's a brand new aircraft. I haven't got the model of F-35 this is, but it doesn't bode well, does it, if we've got manufacturing defects in this particular aircraft?
Well, it doesn't really matter which model it is, in a sense, because if this is crumbling material, then this will be common parts across every variant. But it's amusing that last week, I think it was, they announced that the first aircraft carrier, when it becomes operational in the mid-2020s, will be manned mainly by American pilots with American aircraft, because we won't have enough of them yet. But it seems that if you're going to put aircraft into a hostile environment like the ocean, if it's crumbling due to corrosion, that doesn't
it's going to have a
well,
problem.
Does it?
Yeah. It doesn't. David, I don't know whether you've heard anything on this separately, but the whole thing about the carriers and the F-35s is, I think it's outrageous. I can't think of any other description. Because what we've effectively done is wiped out our carrier expertise. Of course, it's not just a question of the ship and the aircraft. You have to integrate a very complex team of people to make the thing operate. And that has been completely destroyed. And I believe that was deliberately done. And as you've pointed out, the old Harrier, which was performing satisfactorily, it might have been aging, but it was still there, still flying. And of course, that was just taken out of commission and sold off for peanuts back to the Americans, I think.
That's completely correct, yes. And prior to it being sold off, it had substantial refit, substantial upgrades with a more modern weapon systems and missiles. Now, the whole point of this, is, of course, is that when you stand back and look at it, clearly what we're going to see is the end of the Royal Navy. And it will just be some kind of three-quarter global navy under whatever EU NAVFOR may well. You know, NATO is just a bus to EU military union, and I believe that that's probably just a bus to three-quarter global if the Russian, Chinese and Indians and whoever else don't succumb to this globalist agenda. So, you know, yes, you know, of course, we don't need British Harrier jump jets and British industry if there isn't going to be a Britain, is there? You know, this is the bottom line. And I had about an hour's conversation last week with the former First Sea Lord on this and what we were going to do about it, what could possibly be done about it, how we would press an argument and how we would leverage some sense for them to turn the money back on to actually, you know, facilitate what this particular admiral wanted, which was, you know, a sensible amount of ships and a safe Royal Navy. Well, of course, the big problem we've got is, of course, is how we tactically go about that. And we had a difference of opinion over how that would be achieved. You know, I fundamentally have not seen, from my point of view over these years now, any sense emanating from the MPs. And it's their responsibility to make law and make policy on this, and we're just not getting it. So it doesn't matter how much time and effort you put into pressing your MP, because they are at the other end of the command chain in the party system. And it's the big wigs in the party that answer to the backroom boys that make the decisions, not the MPs. And this is why we've got the problem.
Yeah, thank you for that. Well, if the front end of the military is being attacked at the moment by our own government, then the same is going on for support. And this is an extremely interesting article in the Mail. It's talking about a company called Red Snapper Recruitment. But it says a married couple paid $5 million a year from your taxes to build cases against our troops. Marine A is Blackman. They're still talking about him because he's still behind bars. But this husband and wife team are pulled in to help find staff for the Iraq Historic Allegations team and set up by Tony Blair. So the man that starts the killing then sets up a special team to pull out of the woodwork any British forces who've committed a crime. This is really outrageous. The soldiers are taken to court. Meanwhile, Tony Blair, of course, is completely immune to any form of justice. So if I just bring a figure up on that slide, please, Theo. So here we are, Red Snapper Recruitment. They trebled their turnover to 20.5 million in 3 years. A nice smiling husband and wife team who were suddenly picking up the most extraordinary contracts. And I think we've got to ask ourselves how this works. You can go and check this out. So we've got public sector transactions of Red Snapper Recruitment made with the Ministry of Justice. And that's part of it. If you go down the list here, there's also MOD. We've got vast sums of money mentioned. Now, we've had a quick look at this morning. I'm going to say to our audience, can you give us some help on this? Because what are these contracts that this husband and wife team are winning? What are these contracts? And how on earth do you suddenly get into lucrative, high-level contracts with the Ministry of Defence or the Ministry of Justice? There's another part to the page. Here, Ministry of Justice spend over 25,000 in the probation trusts. Big figures. We haven't got detail on it. We are asking for help. What is all this about? But one thing we can tell you is that two ladies turned up from Red Snapper claiming to be probation officers around child abuse whistleblower Melanie Shaw in Nottingham. And Melanie was outraged by the pitiful, unprofessional performance of these two women. She was so outraged about it, she actually recorded a message on her phone saying, who on earth are these women? And to try and make this comment fair, Melanie also has been very outspoken about the public sector probation officers that she's been dealing with in Nottingham, and she can't praise them enough for the fact that they've been fair and reasonable and professional. So we've got Red Snapper, husband and wife, nice looking couple, suddenly getting high level contracts, and they are producing the people to help prosecute members of the British Armed Forces who've been out there doing Tony Blair's dirty work. This is obscene stuff, David. I really find it difficult to choose my words carefully for the normal polite language of the UK column.
They're just absolutely beggars belief that we've got somebody in Whitehall has dreamt this scheme up to go and pursue foot soldiers, Royal Marines, so on and so forth. It is absolutely perverse.
Yeah, perverse. Well, the article carried on going because it had more on this business of three soldiers who could possibly face charges for the killing of an Iraqi. He drowned in a canal, but there were very strange circumstances at the time, including a riot. And a previous investigation has said, well, we can't really get to the bottom of what was taking place when this young man drowned. But now there's a possibility that a major and two soldiers are going to be put under the spotlight. Colonel Richard Kemp here has really said it as it should be. This is disgraceful given the flaws in the original investigation. It is ridiculous that soldiers should be hounded for 13 years of their lives after putting their lives on the line. This is the difference, isn't it? Tony Blair, of course, sat totally safe, warm, in his plush carpeted office while he ordered the killing, but the people had to go out there and put their own lives at risk are the ones that are now brought back into the court system. And just before I pass back to you, we'll bring in this article as well, because I think the two of them go together. This is the Mail exposing that millions of pounds of money given to charities which should have been helping veterans has disappeared, just literally disappeared, or been wasted on unproven therapies. And this has all come from George's Osborne LIBOR fund. So 35 million taken from those naughty banks, Mike. Nobody went to prison, but they... What's 35 million from the international banking scene? I couldn't get enough zeros after the point, could I really? But a minuscule amount of money. But this is the sort of stuff going on. The Warrior Program claiming to use timeline therapy and neurolinguistic programming, which wasn't working. Veterans Council, well, they swallowed half a million, but there is a website under construction, so that's good useful. We've got Veterans First. They're interesting. They got 2.56 million. They were to set up centres across Scotland with additional funding by the NHS, but I think there's only a few centres, and at the moment, questions being asked about their accounts. And Veterans Outreach, who got 414,000, and they were pushing a therapy which was again unproven. So money wasted, unproven remedies, non-existent facilities. This can't be accidental, David. I do not believe that that our society as a whole is so incompetent. This could happen. This has been encouraged. It's been allowed to happen by the government in order to sell short our veterans.
I mean, it's just outrageous, isn't it? I mean, what we need, let's be absolutely, you know, succinct with this. What we need is Colonel Kemp and Mike Rose or whoever else in charge of Defence Committee and, you know, somebody with some proper balls to be Minister of Defence. I mean, what are they doing? This is just outrageous with the direction that they're going here with this, and it needs pulling up. Right. And it is pulling up now.
Well, I'll add to that comment that UK Column has been approached several times over the last few years by veterans who've been through the so-called help services. Two independent people from different parts of the country, one a paratrooper, one a normal army regiment, were talking about being told they should commit suicide by the psychiatrists who were apparently supposed to be helping them. And then we've also had a number of stories, including from young Royal Marines, talking about wounded troops who were perfectly healthy in a mental sense when they came back from Iraq. They only had light wounds, very minor wounds. But when these lads were seen some months later, they were literally out of their minds on psychotropic drugs. And one young Royal Marine who had back problems was told that he should take psychotropic drugs. And when he said, but I haven't got any stress problems, I've actually got a bad back, he was told that he should take the drug as a prophylactic measure in case he was later to develop PTSD. So the comment from these young soldiers were they were seeing veterans destroyed by the type of therapy and the type of drugs given to them. Now, that is a very, very sinister allegation, but we have heard this story from numerous former members of the armed forces. David, there is something very malevolent going on at the moment, which it seems to me is designed to completely destroy Britain's capability to defend itself.
Completely. Yeah, that's exactly the case. And that's been articulated in a kind of sort of very reversing or soft fashion over the weekend in the Financial Times and front page of the Times on Saturday. And we're seeing these comments come out. But what's got to happen? You know, with the comments in the Times on Saturday, and then whatever was in the Express and the Guardian, this is now common knowledge. It's an open secret. Britain can't defend itself. And what we really need is these admirals and generals. There are some of them, but what we need is enough of them to go up to number 10, like Sir John Fieldhouse and Sir Henry Leach did, knock on the door properly and go, enough. They've got to have the balls to do it, and they need to justify, and I've been told this by a couple of admirals, I want to be able to justify my gold braid and my name up there in the Admiralty Board in gold leaf. And this is what's got to happen. There's enough shilly-shallying about now. You know, this is now a margin call. It's got to happen, and it's got to happen quickly, because this just cannot go on.
Yeah, David, thank you very much for that analysis. And I totally agree. We're in extremely dangerous times. For people who think, well, it's the military that go overseas and do and they do the killing. This is true. However, of course, when the tables are turned and the civilian population in this country needs protection, possibly from our own government, then we need these people. So much as the police don't be put off by a few bad apples, we need these public services properly run in order to protect and support the public. Thank you very much for joining us. That brings us to the end of today's news. If you like what we do, please consider taking out a subscription or making a donation. We need your ongoing support to keep doing what we're doing. And we would like to expand in certain areas. We can only do this with your financial support. Thank you very much, David. Thank you. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. And before I forget, tomorrow evening at the George Hotel Plimpton, we will be having a briefing, the first of a series of more formal evenings once a month, third Wednesday of the month. So if you're local or you can travel, please come and join us. Thank you. Bye-bye. All right.